This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, New York City police are stopping and searching people on the subways.
Find out what random searches on the subways really mean.
Also joining us will be John Heffetz from the Al Marie legal team to discuss the other person besides Padilla who's being held as an enemy combatant since 2001.
Al Marie and Padilla both held under the exact same circumstances, but Al Marie has significantly different rights simply because he's not a U.S. citizen.
And we'll be talking about shield laws in this country.
Without national shield laws, journalists all across the country and their sources are completely vulnerable.
We'll learn about who's watching us in New York City. Bill Brown will join us to talk about his surveillance camera tours.
Every day as you walk through Manhattan, you're being watched by more than 15,000 cameras.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. Michael Smith and Michael Ratner won't be with us today, but Dahlia Hashad joins us by remote. After the recent subway bombings in London, the pressure is on for cities in the United States to build up the police state with total surveillance. Surveillance technology has advanced from grainy black and white images to digital high-resolution cameras with zoom lenses. A baseball can be recognized from orbiting satellites. Privacy activist Bill Brown gives walking tours of New York's most camera-crowded areas, sometimes waving copies of the Constitution in front of the all-seeing eye and sticking notices under each camera warning, "You are being watched. Surveillance camera notice." We're delighted to have Bill Brown with us in the studio today. Bill, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
How did you get started on doing the walking tours of surveillance cameras?
The walking tours started in May of 2000 because we began to make maps of publicly installed surveillance cameras in New York City. And that, in its turn, was so that we would have something to hand out when the performing group, the surveillance camera players, would perform underneath a publicly installed surveillance camera. So we'd usually hand out a flyer explaining what we're doing here and why. And then we thought it would be even better to, instead of identifying the single camera we were underneath, but show the bystanders all the cameras that were around them. And once we had the maps, we had to figure out something even better to do with them than just that. And that's how the walking tours got started.
And you're in all five boroughs?
No, not yet. Mostly because making the maps is a very time-consuming process. It requires walking up and down and looking at the facades of every single building on these streets. We've only been concentrating on Manhattan, and there are 12 locations in Manhattan that we've mapped out and offer walking tours based upon those maps. But there are selected areas, for example, in the South Bronx and Williamsburg, where we've begun to do maps because those are areas that are rapidly gentrifying. And what we found is that the cameras are not in places presumably that are poor or where there are high crime rates. The cameras are instead in places where there's a lot of property worth protecting. And, of course, that's what's happening in Williamsburg and the South Bronx.
Now, are most of the cameras privately owned or publicly owned?
I'd say 90% of them are privately owned, that is, installed on privately owned buildings. And 10% or less are installed on city-owned property like poles, lampposts, or on city, state, or federal governments. And this is a very interesting fact because it shows that the police have just begun or barely just begun to actually install surveillance cameras in public places, and it's the private sector that's well ahead of the game.
Who monitors these surveillance cameras, the tapes on them?
That's almost impossible to say, and you'd have to go on a case-by-case basis. But my sense is that, say, 25% of the cameras are dummies and don't even work or are so old they have broken down. A good 50% of them, let's say, would go right to tape or to a hard drive or some sort of digital recorder, and then maybe 25% of them are actually monitored in real time in addition to going right to a recording unit.
Do you have a sense of how the tapes are actually used in prosecuting crimes, for example?
Yes, I do. And they are not really used in the court process, properly speaking. And I've heard this both here in the United States and recently a barrister in Australia said the exact same thing, which is that a prosecutor will confront a defendant who is either poor, uneducated, or badly represented and will say, we have a videotape of you committing the crime, and therefore, because of the disadvantages the defendant faces, he or she simply pleads guilty then and there. And the videotape is never introduced as evidence. And it seems unfortunate because if the person were to say, I don't care if you have a picture of me shaking hands with Elvis Presley, I want you to see that that evidence be admitted by a judge, because it's quite possible that it would not be admissible given the problems that one has with the Fourth Amendment and the right of privacy in this country.
Do you think the cameras serve any deterrent purpose?
No. I think they do not serve any deterrent purpose whatsoever. And this has really, in a kind of a nightmarish way, been illustrated by what happened on July 7th in London, when four or five suicide bombers went into the most heavily surveilled city in the Western world, were undeterred, and were photographed on their way to their mission, so that we now have blurry surveillance tape of people who are now already dead, and that it will never indeed deter somebody. And this is something very important because even as we speak, the mayor of New York City, the police commissioner, and other people who presumably speak in our names are saying that we need more surveillance cameras to deter and prevent terrorist activity in this city. And that seems to be a plainly irrational claim.
Isn't it true that some people who might commit acts of violence would actually want to be captured on tape, sort of a martyr thing?
Absolutely. So that you can see people, potential martyrs, suicide bombers in the occupied territories in Palestine, the last thing they do before crossing the border is have a picture of them taken. So that indeed being photographed on the way to the mission is not a deterrent, but actually an encouragement.
Well, on our website, lawanddisorder.org, we actually have posted a still frame of the alleged bombers entering the London subway. Someone remarked that it looked as though it might have been doctored. Do you think this is feasible?
I've looked at it actually myself because this was reported by bettergovernment.org in England, claiming that one of the four alleged bombers has actually been brought in using Photoshop. And unfortunately, it would take both an expert to do such doctoring and an expert to reveal that such doctoring had been done, so that ordinary folks such as ourselves simply have to believe the picture as presented to us. And of course, if we're relying solely on photographs, yes, it is possible, given an expert and given a nice brand new up-to-date version of Photoshop, that you could airbrush, as it were, anyone into a photograph. And that's part of the problem about relying on videotapes being introduced as evidence, is there's always a possibility that they've been doctored and that it's a different type of witness than somebody who can be sworn in on pain of perjury saying that, no, my testimony is not coerced, this is truthful, where a photograph or a videotape cannot be sworn in that way.
Going back to the issue of public versus private ownership, in the subway system, for example, I imagine that the cameras are under the purview of, say, for example, the New York City Police Department. Do you know if that's correct?
It's a mixture, yes. So that you have the New York City Police Department operating some cameras. Some cameras are operated by the Police Department of the MTA. And then there would, of course, depending on your location, be cameras operated by the FBI or other federal agencies, depending on their interests. And I saw very briefly on Fox TV News, which I occasionally watch, that there are over 2,000 police, that is NYPD or MTA police, over 2,000 cameras in the subways right at this moment. And, of course, London has 6,000 in their subways at this moment as well.
Bill, some listeners might be thinking that we're paranoid with all this talk of ubiquitous surveillance cameras. What do the cameras look like?
Well, I'll first say that the people who are paranoid aren't you and I who are concerned about surveillance. The people who are paranoid are the ones who are putting in all the cameras. So just to make that clear. But yes, when you talk about the existence of all these cameras, you might appear to be overwrought or overly concerned because the cameras do not look like cameras. They're often designed to look like lamps or ornaments, circular devices in unusual locations. And they are not accompanied by signs that plainly inform the passersby there is a camera, who it's operated by, and why they are operating that camera. So that if you're concerned about your safety, you should actually be addressed and say, we're the NYPD, this is our surveillance camera, we're keeping you safe. And by the same token, it should actually deter or prevent criminals who also read that very same sign and say, we're the NYPD, we're watching you, don't even think about committing a crime here. And in the absence of that sign, everybody is left guessing.
Aside from subways and the visible large buildings outside, are cameras installed in any other places that listeners might want to know about?
Now, mind you, I'm interested almost exclusively in cameras in public places because that's where I think there's the most erosion of the basic rights defined under the Bill of Rights. So that there'll be surveillance cameras in almost every private establishment, business, home, anywhere that you would go. And the same thing is true in public places. Once you get the habit of looking for them, you'll see that they're virtually everywhere. And that a disadvantage we face as New Yorkers is we never look up. We're always looking down at the ground. And ironically, the cameras are always above our heads shooting down upon us. So you'd have to change the entire way that you walk around the city, where you're looking, to discover that you're watched almost at all times.
Speaking on a broader sociological level, have you noticed that awareness of cameras results in different behavior from those being watched?
I would think so. And according to this sort of schema, I think it's pretty well established that people who have spent all their lives watching television are very passive and will treat events or people right in front of them as if they are a kind of reality TV and they do not intervene. That would be doubled if surveillance cameras are widely installed and commonly known, because people would treat it as if it's just another television camera, but even more exclusively, it's the police who are watching. So therefore, if somebody sees a surveillance camera, they'd say, I don't need to intervene to help that woman with her pocketbook or her child, because after all, I could get hurt, and it's the job of the specialists, the people watching the cameras. And that's moving in the opposite direction than I think we should be going, which is taking care of ourselves, policing our own communities, so that way we can better protect ourselves instead of passively waiting for an expert to intercede and help us.
Our producer, Jeff Brady, actually went on one of the surveillance walking tours a few years ago. We turn now to a clip from that tour.
The law that I believe they're violating, which is the Fourth Amendment, which is still in effect despite the Patriot Act, which says, I'll give it some nice lighting, this is the Fourth Amendment, the United States Constitution, which says in its inimitable style, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. There is not one idea in this law that this camera is not violating. There is no probable cause to believe that at 2:39 p.m. on this Sunday, a crime was going to take place, not over there, not in the window where the person is looking, but down here. No probable cause. There is no judge in the Viper unit saying, yes, you had a right to look at this person at this particular time. And note that there is not anyone going up to us and searching our bags and saying, what's in your pocket there? What they are doing is not physical searches and seizures, but televisual searches and seizures.
What kind of feedback on that topic do you get from people taking the tours? Are they surprised or are they comforted that they're being watched by the authorities?
The people who come to our weekly walking tours are, you might say, the usual suspects. That is, they're people who have already made up their minds that they don't like the surveillance cameras, and I think they want to be around people who think as they do, because it can be a very lonely experience in a society such as ours, which is very isolated and atomizing, to find people who think as you do. So they are never comforted by the presence of the cameras and are always shocked when they see very small cameras, or they're informed about exactly what the powers of these cameras are, because some of them can see images or people clearly from up to a mile away, further than the human eye is able to see.
A mile away, that's stunning. How many manufacturers of these cameras are there? Do you know?
There are a great many, and they tend to be both American and British companies, EMI, Philips, Pelco, and they will use the camera itself as a kind of billboard to advertise the company name, because the name of the camera maker is always right on the camera itself.
Bill, in addition to surveillance cameras in the city, are we being watched by satellites?
Yes, we are. We're being watched by satellites, spy planes, and helicopters, all of which are above us, and all of which can focus in on us on the ground with really alarming precision. I think we've all seen news helicopters showing a scene on the ground. But there are planes that exist way above that can be watching us. There are F-16 fighter planes over New York, which could even zoom in on the helicopters below them, watching the ground below the helicopters. And the satellites, even though they're 20 miles above the Earth's surface, use keyhole cameras, which are the most sophisticated cameras ever really manufactured. And they can zoom in with such precision that they can easily distinguish a building or vehicles from each other by their size and shape. And I'm sure, even though we probably aren't allowed to see the feeds that come from these military satellites, they can surely see human shapes on the ground, and that it is only a matter of time before satellites are really the devices that are tasked with surveilling individual people or simply entire populations of people.
So in the future, is it possible that the city cameras that you're showing people might be replaced by that kind of technology totally?
I don't think so, because the cameras will stay up now even though they don't work or they've been discarded. Because I think it's an admission of failure on the camera owners if they take down a camera that doesn't work and they seem to have a sentimental attachment to leaving them in place. So they rust and break and are just left there. But yes, functionally, I think that's quite possible that they'll stop looking through the ground-based cameras and will only be looking at us through aerospace-based cameras.
If listeners are interested in partaking of your walks, how do they find out the schedule?
There's a phone number, 212-561-0106, that every week will describe the location of the upcoming walking tour. Or they could go online at notbored.org, notbored.org. And see the schedule of all of the tours that we offer, and it now extends into September of this year. And if they're having a hard time with any of those things, just search for the phrase through Google or another search engine, surveillance cameras and walking tours, and they'll find themselves to the exact right page.
And how much do the tours cost?
Each of the tours are $5 per person. And for that hopefully modest price, you receive copies of all the maps that I've made of that location, so that way you can see the progress of the development of cameras over these last 5 years, and a tour that I believe will change your impression of New York City forever.
Bill, you do a fabulous service to people in New York City. Thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was privacy activist and New York City surveillance camera tour guide Bill Brown. Last week, we talked to Bill Goodman from the Center for Constitutional Rights on random subway searches in New York City. That was part of our special fundraising program for Law and Disorder. And by the way, we'd like to thank our listeners so much for their many contributions to WBAI. Let's turn now to that segment.
And we have on the phone Bill Goodman, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who will talk to us about probably one of the most important issues going on today, which is what they're doing to New Yorkers on the subway.
Bill Goodman, this is Michael Smith. I'm here with Michael Ratner.
Yes, hi. It's always good, Bill.
What's your take on the subway searches?
Oh, I think it's a part of the changes that are occurring in this country before our eyes that are so disturbing, in which the society in which we have some real basis for saying that their democratic rights is changing to one where those democratic rights are evaporating. I mean, there are millions of New Yorkers on the subways every day.
4 million, I think, Bill.
They're now talking about random searches, and I question the randomness. That's another issue. We can talk about that in a minute. But random searches of what? Probably tens of thousands of those people. And people are now expected to open up their pockets and their packages to police officers. And so the state of mind of people is now one, well, yes, it's fine for a police officer to search me. And the state of mind of police officers is I can stop whoever I want without reasonable suspicion, which is a requirement of the Fourth Amendment. And, you know, there might be some argument for it. If it had any hope of working. But this is a system in which, by its own admission, if someone doesn't want to be searched, they can walk away. And they can walk to the next subway stop, and if they have something that's dangerous or deathly, they can enter the subway system somewhere else.
But, Bill, do you take your life in your hands by that after that London killing? If someone refuses to open their bag and they're wearing a bulky coat, is that person going to be shot in the head?
Well, I think that's another problem. Yes, I think there's certainly a serious possibility of that. But at least on its face, the system is one in which people are allowed to walk away. So here you have police stopping, searching, questioning, frisking thousands and thousands of people, and the ability to really prevent terrorism is de minimis.
I didn't know they were allowed to frisk as well as search knapsacks.
Well, I think that what will happen is that they'll say that they perceive some danger, and they'll start frisking these things.
Now, Bill, what if they open my bag and they find my stash of marijuana in there? They can't arrest me for that, can they?
I think that they are not allowed to do that, as I understand the current state of Fourth Amendment law now.
But I think, go ahead.
Because it's a random stop. There's no probable cause for the stop.
Unless afterwards they say that it wasn't random, that they identified you for a particular reason.
It's a consent, though, Bill. It's not really what you've said to us.
Yeah, because you can walk away.
It's a consent. If you can walk away, and if I give them the right to go into my bag,
I think that's right. I think you're right that you do open yourself up to this being admissible evidence against you because you are consenting in a sense.
So you got to be careful. I mean,
So give the stash to me before you get on the train.
But it certainly changes our ability to move freely about the city in so many different ways. And obviously, as I said, the randomness thing is subject to huge concern. Here's the New York Police Department, which just emerged from the settlement of the street crime unit stop and frisk policy, where basically they settled a case in which they'd been engaging in racial stereotyping and racial profiling of thousands and thousands and thousands of New Yorkers.
I want to say something, Bill, about that, because you're not taking credit for that. That was Bill Goodman was the architect of that case. It took place after the Diallo murder, the 41 shots case. And Bill decided that on behalf of the Center for Constitutional Rights, we should sue to dissolve the special crime unit of the police department. And no one thought there was a shot. Bill essentially won that case. That unit's been dissolved. That it's being monitored. The victory really took place right on the edge of 9/11, as I recall.
That's right. And in many ways, you can say it's a hollow victory, given this new muscular police department thrust to search, stop, and search all of these people. And sir, undoubtedly, people are going to be racially profiled around this stuff. And it's going to take years and years before we're able to document it, just like it took years and years before we were able to document what the street crime unit was doing.
We need to move away from the idea that these searches are going to be random. I mean, look already at what subway stations are being affected, and it seems that a lot of the ones that are in Arab and Muslim neighborhoods have police there.
That's right. I think that we just have to expect that this is going to be, that we're going to be, you're going to be targeting Arabs and South Asians and people, you know, and Muslims. There's no doubt about it. There's now an argument within the right that racial profiling is absolutely appropriate when it comes to these particular peoples.
Well, it makes us more secure, right? We got to give up some of our civil liberties if we're not going to get blown up on the IRT.
But I think
what do you say about that? But Bill Goodman, Director of Litigation at the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Bill, some of our listeners may be aware but not totally aware about the issue of randomness. For example, it's okay for law enforcement to stop cars if they do it like every 10th car. I think one of the issues aside from racial profiling is how do you really implement that in a subway when it's crowded and people are coming through 10 different turnstiles?
I think it's virtually impossible. How can a police officer claim to do this randomly when, as you say, people are coming at him from all directions or her? And they've got to, you know, they somehow have to pick. Now, they can say, I'm counting everyone who's coming from my left, or I'm counting everyone who's going through turnstile A. It's so fraught with the ability to opportunistically alter your testimony in order to say, yes, it was random, that I just don't think it has any reliability at all.
Now, you know, of course, about eyewitness video, found the doctored videotape from the RNC. Do you think, I've heard rumors that there may be people going down into the subways with video cameras to document some of these stops. Is that still lawful to bring a video camera down there?
I believe that it's lawful to take a video camera anywhere into any public place, or any camera into any public place. I think this is something that's going to be tested. There was a very bad opinion out of the Southern District of New York on this issue in which it was claimed that there's no First Amendment right whatsoever was implicated by this. What you're talking about, I think, would be very good, which is the videotaping of these stops in order to try and provide some kind of counterbalance on this issue of randomness and let the cops know that we're watching them.
You know, we might also try a little testing like we do in housing discrimination cases. Send some people down who are obviously Muslim in a controlled test and see what happens.
Because you have dark eyes, because you have dark hair and dark skin, you're an automatic suspect.
And that's why people get shot in the head.
That's why people are killed and alienated on a daily basis.
Absolutely. I was in a security checkpoint at a courthouse, I'm not going to say which one, in the New York area last week, and I heard one of the security officers say to the other officer, stop anyone who's dark. He said, I know that it's politically incorrect, but that's what I think we need to do.
If you got stopped and asked to look in your bag, do you think we should walk away? Do you think we should cooperate with the searches? What would you do?
I would always walk away, but obviously it depends, and this is the pernicious quality of it. It depends on what kind of hurry I'm in, how anxious I am to get where I'm going, and whether I'm willing to just sacrifice my rights for a little bit of convenience. And this is the price. This is how we lose our liberty a little bit at a time every day. And if you multiply it by the tens of thousands of people who are going to be stopped, it's massive. If you take a look at what happened during the Republican convention in this city, it was a huge suspension of the Constitution for those days and for all of the times that people had to go back to court. And we are slowly but certainly becoming more and more and more of a police state. This is an extremely dangerous period that we're in, and I think that this is merely one more added measure to it.
We've said repeatedly on our program You can't have democracy at home in an imperial system abroad. The United States is in 120 countries, got 730-some bases around the world, and what it's doing in Iraq is what's causing this. And I think the clear answer to all these people is get out and demonstrate. I think it's September 24th. Get out of Iraq now.
We've talked about what if they find something illegal like marijuana, but one question, which I know took place in the 80s and the 70s when the FBI could inspect something, they would frequently take your address book and make a little copy of your address book and then open files on every single person in the address book. Do you think they could basically pull you aside and say, oh, we have an interest in you, we're going to make a copy of your address book as well?
I think they will, and then the question of whether they can is going to be determined by some court someday. But I certainly think that they're going to do that. If people have computers on them, they're going to, you know, and they look suspicious, or for some reason some cop wants to push the point, maybe they'll try and take the hard drive for a little while and make copies of that. I think we can expect all of this to happen.
Is there any sort of number people can call if they get into trouble here? They call the National Lawyers Guild, the ACLU, or the NYCLU, the Center for Constitutional Rights, that we should probably begin to document all over the city everything that's happening on these, the people who, all of us who use the subway, and maybe set up a citywide hotline.
I think we need to set up a task force. There are meetings coming that are happening over the next several days, in fact, of people who are very concerned about this. Some of it at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I'm sure that it's happening elsewhere also. And sooner or later, hopefully sooner, these groups have to coalesce, and we have to have a coalition that's fighting this stuff.
In the meantime, people can report their stops and searches at nyclu.org. Thank you, Bill Goodman.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Bye, Bill.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Bill Goodman on Law and Disorder. He's been discussing what to do when you go on to the subway.
That was Bill Goodman, legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights. Listeners are familiar with the case of Jose Padilla, where the government arrested an American citizen on U.S. soil and sent him to military custody for punishment. But many of you have probably not heard of the case of Ali Saleh Kala Almari, who's also been held in custody for several years. We're pleased to be joined by John Hafetz, who is on the Almari legal team, to discuss the other person besides Padilla who's being held as an enemy combatant since 2001. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So everybody's focused on the enemy combatants that we all know about in Guantanamo, but very few know really the full story about the enemy combatants here in the United States. Can you tell us a little bit about your client?
Yes, our client is Ali Almari, and he's a citizen of Qatar, and he is one of two individuals that are being held as an enemy combatant in the United States, and he's the only non-citizen who's being held as an enemy combatant here. He's being held under very severe conditions at the Consolidated Naval Brig in South Carolina.
Well, and that's where Jose Padilla is being held, right?
Exactly.
So he's the other. So we know about, most people know about Yasser Issam Hamdi, the enemy combatant that was held at first at Guantanamo Bay, and after it was discovered that he was a citizen, he was moved to the U.S. And he has since been released after under a deal after he gave up his U.S. citizenship. And Jose Padilla is the second enemy combatant, right?
That's correct.
And then the third is Almari.
That's correct.
Why do people not know about the Almari case?
I think people know about it. I think they don't know as much about it as Jose Padilla because he's not a citizen. It hasn't gotten the same degree of attention, and he has never been given any kind of hearing or process. So I think that's another reason that there hasn't been as much attention on him.
Why is he being held, or why is the government saying he's being held?
The government, based on solely on a hearsay declaration, a multiple-level hearsay declaration from a Department of Defense functionary, alleges that he came to the United States to conduct a wave of attacks after September 11th.
I understand he entered the United States on the unfortunate date of September 10th, yeah?
That's correct.
So they're saying a wave of attacks. What evidence have they offered to support this assertion?
They've not really offered any evidence, and they've certainly not offered any evidence in any way that Mr. Almari has had a chance to be heard and to challenge it. Little's been offered against him, and unlike Jose Padilla, Mr. Almari was actually charged criminally. He was arrested in December of 2001 as a material witness for the investigation of September 11th, and then he was charged in February of 2002 with various commercial fraud charges, making false statements, type of charges that are brought against thousands of people. And he was in the criminal justice system and prosecuted for approximately 16 months. And then shortly before his trial and on the eve of hearings to suppress evidence against him, he was suddenly taken from jail in Illinois, where his case was being prosecuted, and moved out to the naval brig in South Carolina and was basically just stripped from a federal criminal proceeding. And that has never happened in the history of the United States.
I got suspicious the moment you mentioned that he was first arrested as a material witness, because as we've discussed on a previous show, it seems to be a trend among the Department of Justice after 9/11 to abuse the material witness law, which is really only supposed to be used to secure witnesses' testimony, not to secure the detention of a criminal suspect. So the Department of Justice has been abusing the material witness law to hold Muslims and others who they want to accuse of crimes but don't have the requisite criminal standard of proof to hold.
That's right. He's like those people who've been arrested under the material witness statute in the way you describe, but then he's further been, unlike those people, he's actually then been taken and detained as an enemy combatant after he was charged, which places him in an entirely unique category.
So what's the difference between him and everybody else?
The other material witnesses were not declared enemy combatants. They were not moved to a military brig, and they've not been held for over 2 years in conditions of confinement that are worse than we have for the most dangerous convicted criminals in the United States, having been to Guantanamo, are as bad or worse than the worst at Guantanamo.
Have you seen any evidence that proffered by the government that might help support their allegations?
We've seen nothing that would sustain their charges, and what Mr. Almari is asking for is the same thing that Jose Padilla is asking for, which is to be charged and to be tried in a criminal proceeding. That's been the way this country has operated. That's been the basic foundation of due process, and that's been the rule of law as we've understood it. People who are civilians in the United States, regardless of whether they're citizens or non-citizens, who are arrested on suspicion of wrongdoing, have a right to be brought into court and charged and tried. And Mr. Almari has been denied that right. And based on what they're doing to him, they could do that to any other of the 20 million non-citizens in this country.
As I understand it, he had been here in the United States before. He was studying here. He was a student. And he came back for his graduate studies, bringing with him his wife and children.
That's correct.
What's happened to them?
They've since gone back to Qatar.
Yeah, I don't blame them, as will, I imagine, many foreign students or people without citizenship.
That's right. It's a very, very scary prospect.
So how did the court justify creating this subclass of people, otherwise known as immigrants or people who don't have citizenship here in the States? How did they justify this? Because as I understand it, in the Padilla decision, the decision that Padilla had to be charged within 45 days or released, that really didn't hinge on his citizenship status. It was more a sense of, this is how we do things in the United States. We don't hold people forever in detention. How could that not apply to non-citizens?
Well, we were surprised, as you were, Dahlia. Appeared to be the way the judge's decision in Padilla read, but the judge said there's always been distinctions between citizens and non-citizens, or as you say, citizens and aliens, and he basically justified it on that. And certainly there are differences. Non-citizen, if he violates or she violates the immigration laws, may be, you know, deported from the country, but that's an entirely different situation than the notion that the president can lock up in prison or in a military prison a non-citizen forever without ever getting any kind of hearing.
Yeah, I don't think people really have a good grasp of the idea that the Constitution really applies to all people. There are very few instances where the Constitution singles out people who are not citizens, such as people who may vote or sit on juries or run for president. You know, there's certain instances in our government where we do isolate non-citizens from citizens, but typically the right to a trial and the right to due process has never been one of those.
That's exactly right. And today, as we speak now, there are, you know, thousands of people being processed on criminal charges in the criminal justice system, citizen and non-citizen alike, and it makes no difference in terms of the process they get and how they're treated. They're treated identical for the basic principles of due process and the other constitutional rights you described.
What do you think will happen on appeal?
Well, we're going to continue to challenge it. We ultimately hope and believe that we'll be vindicated. We believe this country, you know, stands for certain principles, and this case is just so far beyond those that it will not be allowed by the courts ultimately.
What can we urge our listeners to do?
I think to be aware of the case and to be speaking about the case and aware of the dangers of the case that it poses for everyone and for every non-citizen in this country, Arab, Muslim or not, people from England, people from, you know, that come over or from Germany or France, the same thing. It just draws a very dangerous dividing line. And I think it's important to stand up for the principle that the rule of law applies to all people in the United States.
Since you contacted me about this case, I've been speaking about it publicly, and I have to say, a lot of people just haven't registered the fact that this is going on.
It's very scary, and I just want to add, Dahlia, the other very scary thing is the conditions that Mr. Omari is being held under. In addition to being deprived of the basic due process and rule of law that we talked about, he's being held under incredibly harsh and abusive conditions. He was repeatedly and lawfully interrogated during the 16 months he was held incommunicado. They had threatened to send him to Egypt and to Syria, where they said that they would rape his wife in front of him. And now they've denied him basically all human contact. The only people over the last 2 years that he's been allowed to talk to are the visits from his attorneys, from us, and a few visits from the International Red Cross. He speaks to no one. He's confined in a tiny cell. He's denied all books, news, all religious materials except for the Quran. They've done all kinds of things to punish and humiliate him, such as, you know, denying him water to purify himself before he prays, as every religiously observant Muslim must do, like Mr. Omari, denied him the ability to know what time he has to pray, denied him a head cover, which he has to do.
It sounds like they're really trying to break him down psychologically.
Absolutely.
And for them, they're on a time limit, because they must realize that given how outrageous the government actions are and what they're trying to do, that there is a good chance that a court of law won't stand for it.
But that's correct. That's what we believe. I don't think the American public would stand for it. I think, you know, even people who are accused of bad things or in prison, you know, still deserve to be treated, you know, with certain basic humanity. But the conditions he's under are very dangerous and very bad and are gravely jeopardizing both his physical and his mental health.
Absolutely. Thank you, John.
John, why wasn't Almari shipped to Guantanamo?
Well, I'm not certain why. I don't know the government's motives. I can suspect that even the United States government recognized that taking an individual from the United States and bringing them to Guantanamo would have raised the type of outcry. So they did not do so.
You're also representing Almari's brother, aren't you, who's in Guantanamo?
That's correct. His Ali Almari's brother, Jerala Almari, his younger brother, has been detained as an enemy combatant in Guantanamo since February of 2002.
You were just down there. Can you describe the conditions in Guantanamo as you saw them?
Well, the conditions are very dire, and his brother is being held under the most severe conditions there, and they are, you know, absolutely terrible in a number of different respects, and they're very, very dangerous to the people there.
What's the difference between the conditions in the military brig and Guantanamo in terms of treatment of detainees?
One difference is complete isolation that Ali Almari has in South Carolina. Prisoners at Guantanamo are there with other prisoners. So although many are in isolation, under terrible isolation, there is slightly more contact.
And you'd been in Guantanamo 2 years ago. Had you seen a difference in conditions this time?
Well, I was in Guantanamo in April of 2005, so it was about just several months ago.
Oh.
But the conditions are as bad, if not worse, than before.
And were they making any effort to hide these conditions to visitors?
When someone goes down, say, from the press or from the United States government, they are not seeing what's really going on in Guantanamo.
John, it's been an honor to have you with us today. Thank you so much for the important work that you're doing.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me.
That was John Hafitz of the Almari Legal Team.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud. Say I'm clear for the whole round.
Over 30 years ago, the United States Supreme Court recognized in Brandsburg v. Hayes that news gathering is not without First Amendment protections. The justices, however, could not agree about the form or extent of those protections. Therefore, no nationally recognized news gatherer's privilege exists, but rather is in a patchwork of inconsistent court decisions and state statutes. Joining us to talk about that today is Jean Polosinski from the First Amendment Center. Welcome, Jean, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Jean, when reporters or news gatherers are subpoenaed, generally, what kinds of information are being sought?
Well, very often, I think there's not a specific trail. Sometimes prosecutors are aware of specifics of a conversation based on a report, but many times I think they're looking to see what did the reporter gather, and very often it's either to confirm or refute information that the prosecutor may suspect is out there or know of, and to add some credence to perhaps a grand jury investigation. So it really runs the gamut. Rarely is it the smoking gun kind of quote. Very often it's an investigative tool, I think, to lead police and prosecutors to additional development in the case.
And so they may seek unpublished information or notes, that kind of thing?
Right. I mean, it runs the gamut from one's notes or tape of a conversation on the phone to an interview to the outtakes of a television documentary taping or interview taping. So it... all of the things that are involved in news gathering, as opposed to news reporting, which is an instant twist we're not seeing much noted in a lot of the contemporary cases we're seeing. It's not about what they reported. It's about how they gathered the news.
Mm. There are several reasons that news gatherers would want protection from this kind of subpoena. what are some of those reasons?
Well, I can think of two just very quickly. One, obviously, people who have information the public needs to know and for whatever reason they are afraid to disclose openly is information the public may never get if there's not a promise of confidentiality. And then, secondly, there is a tendency in our society now to treat reporters or want to treat reporters as extensions of an established law enforcement operation. You know, while it's true every reporter who is a citizen of the United States is a citizen and has some obligations when subpoenaed or required to testify, you can't ignore the fact that there's also this watchdog on government, fourth estate role that the founders envisioned. And I think if reporters simply become just another tool or ready tool at the hand of a prosecutor, that's going to diminish that ability to be the watchdog on government and to be the place where those frustrated by government, national, local, whatever, you know, they are an alternative. And if they're clearly just at the whim of a prosecutor or some other government official, they're no longer on the outside, they're on the inside of that establishment.
Do you notice any trend, especially in times of national crisis, where reporters and news gatherers may feel more willing to divulge sources and confidential information?
That's a very interesting question. I don't know of a trend where that's the case. I think, again, over the, let's say, the last 30 years since the Brandsburg decision in 72, I believe, there really had been an informal system set up on the federal level where there was a real reluctance, I think, among federal prosecutors to go after reporters with a subpoena, and that there was a strong three-part sort of test that was it absolutely necessary, was it vital to national security, and could you get the information somewhere else? And that system worked, I think, by and large, very well. Now, you would see some, I think, news people over time, over that period, agree to provide some information if other types of information was off limits. They might confirm an interview or agree to testify before a grand jury saying, in fact, that is an accurate representation. My article or my television report is accurate. But they might not give up the name of a source. And for whatever reason, that has broken down in the last 24 to 30 months. What we're seeing now is this, I think, the most serious collision between a free press and government in the last four decades.
You mentioned the Supreme Court case, Brandsburg v. Hayes. Essentially, that said that news gathering is not without First Amendment protections, but the problem was that out of that case didn't come any specific guidelines for what is protected.
My own take on that case was to tell every reporter that ultimately, you, depending where you live in the country, on the federal circuit over the years, but certainly, ultimately, you may face a situation like Judy Miller and Matt Cooper and others, in which it's determined you have no right to keep that secret. And as a matter of conscience, you're going to have to decide whether you obey a lawful court order or you, as a matter of conscience, choose not to. We've seen both examples. Matt Cooper did, and Time Magazine did, and Judy Miller decided that as a matter of conscience, she could not. And it really set that confrontation up.
Speaking of Judy Miller, some people say that she had actually a moral obligation to divulge her sources given the circumstances. Well, what do you think of that?
You know, that gets into less of a First Amendment and, as you point out, a moral obligation. And I'm in an awkward position, if you will, with many of my journalism colleagues, because while I would love the circumstances to be that journalists have the absolute privilege to use confidential sources, I would wish that they would not use them, because I think we live in an environment now with any given day. I think there were two I read of today where the credibility of media is seriously being questioned by the public, and every time you see a confidential source, I think that hurts the credibility of a particular story. So I'm in this position of saying I think it ought to be a journalist's decision, not the government's decision, but I wish journalists would use it extremely rarely, if at all.
Certainly history has shown us that there are some instances in which it's reaped tremendous benefits for society.
Well, I'm not willing to be one of those who excludes it totally because, as you say, we don't know what those circumstances are, and sometimes it may be a person who fears for their life when there was not a prosecution against organized crime, or there was not a sometimes even in terms of industrial espionage, that kind of thing. I mean, there are many circumstances where I can see a person willing to come forward with information, but not to be identified. of course, what a journalist does with that is also another question. Do you treat that, in effect, I think as Judith Miller appears to have been treating it, as information to pursue on the record stories, or do you simply, you know, turn around and use that in a story attributed to an unnamed source? And again, the public, I think, is very ambivalent about that practice.
Essentially, the state of the law, the shield laws nationally, is that there are various levels of protection depending on what state you live in, and we don't have a national shield law.
No, there are even, I think there are three or four circuits in which some form of privilege has been recognized on the federal level, but that's, of course, not been resolved by the Supreme Court, except for the guide in Brandsburg, which is 30 years ago said essentially there wasn't any in those circumstances. So 31 states have state laws providing some sort of shield, and then there are another 18 in which there's been a judicial decision that sets precedent that might establish some privilege for journalists. But again, you know, we have this mishmash of law on the state level and legislation, and then we have this confusing situation within the circuits. The Supreme Court declined to hear the Miller-Cooper appeal. I think the hope is either Congress will establish a shield law, which has its own positives and negatives, or that the Supreme Court would step back into it in some circumstance and settle the issue once again, at least until another round of challenge.
Could you briefly tell us what the First Amendment Center is doing generally?
Well, we're an education information institution, so we don't lobby or litigate. We prepare reports. We analyze First Amendment issues. We work with schools to hopefully better educate young people about five freedoms in the First Amendment. We don't focus specifically on press, although that is a large part of our work. We just published a report examining a constitutional amendment to give Congress the authority to prevent or punish flag desecration. And it's not about whether that amendment is a good idea or not. That's been argued over a number of years, and it actually is right now in the U.S. Senate. It's looking at what happens if such an amendment is adopted and ratified by the states. The report points out that there'll simply be new rounds of litigation, that it won't settle the issue, and it may, in fact, encourage more of that activity,
yes,
at least in the beginning. So we do that kind of information, but we think there's room for a sort of civil discussion in an increasingly shrill environment, I think, in our country.
That's exactly right. And is it the state of the First Amendment is rather dismal these days?
Well, you know, in many ways, it's under challenge. But I also think the marketplace of ideas that, you know, founders envisioned periodically is going to produce that kind of environment. We do an annual survey every year, and actually fewer people than in many, many years said that they felt the First Amendment went too far in the rights it guarantees. So the only encouraging thing, I think, about a lot of these conflicts over religion in schools and public buildings and reporters' privilege and such is that more Americans are really paying attention to the idea of their basic freedoms instead of taking them for granted, and I think we're seeing people beginning to step up and defend them a little more now that they realize what they have and how it's under attack.
Gene, on that positive note, thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for inviting me.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The opinions expressed on today's show are not those of the organizations for which we work.
Trouble in mind, I'm blue, but I won't be blue always. You know the sun gonna shine in my back door someday. I'm gonna lay my head on some lonesome railroad line. I'm gonna let that big 1800 satisfy this mind of mine. Troubling mind, I'm blue, but I won't be blue always. You know the sun gonna shine in my back door someday. My poor heart is beating slow. I ain't never had so much trouble in my life before. Sun gonna shine, I say, in my back door someday.